I know at this time of our practice, a lot of us are wondering about how to carry this practice back into our daily lives. And we may ask ourselves, can we really do it? And sometimes I hear the subject of doubt coming up a lot at a time when we're about to go back into our lives, looking at what's going on in our hearts and wavering a little bit, and then going back to having confidence and back then again to wavering. And so I wanted to speak tonight about faith, because it's such an important part of our ongoing. It's such an important part of our being able to go on with our lives and our practice in our lives. In the Pali language, there is this word, sadda, S-A-D-D-H-A, and it's the Pali word for faith. One of my colleagues, Sharon Salzberg, likes the definition to place one's heart upon, to place one's heart upon. And there's lots of definitions of faith, that, and confidence, conviction. To place one's heart upon is something that feels that it resonates right with me and how I've lived my life through faith. Because it wasn't for me through trying to figure my way out, but it was to going to that place in my heart, mind, having the courage and the confidence to know that I can take this one step. That's all. I can take just this one step. So it's that kind of, it feels like it's just that one step of placing my heart upon just this one moment. And it made it easy from that place. Faith is an inner compass. It's not somebody else's compass. It's our own inner compass that leads us in the right direction, in the direction of liberation, in the direction of wisdom. It's an inner certainty that we land upon. And a lot of times we can't be certain too much far in the future. We can mostly be certain about just this next step that's just hovering over, you know, the next piece of ground that we're going to step on. This inner certainty is a conviction based on one's own experience. And maybe that experience is that I took the last step, I can take this step. And that's all it is. And from there, more and more wisdom comes to us. We come to look at how far we've come, even if we don't think it's very far. We look back a little bit, and that's looking back in a wise way. It's not looking back to compare ourselves with how we did before and compete with our previous best, but to see that we made it to this point, and we have a deep trust that no matter what happens, you know, we've been knocked off the path probably many times, and no matter what happens, we've gotten back on the path. Faith is not based on blind acceptance or blind belief. I love how Utejaniya keeps going back to, at least I've heard him over and over saying, use your own intelligence. Use your own intelligence. And that says a lot. It's in a way, it's borrowing from someone else's faith when someone says, use your own intelligence. It's because maybe that other person has faith in your intelligence. And so we borrow for a moment and say, well, that's right. I can use my own intelligence. If you think I have it, I'll tap into it. It's the choice to investigate. There's a beautiful saying in the Dhamma, ehi pasiko, come and see for yourself. Don't take anybody else's word for it. Come and see for yourself. Munindra used to, I remember when he stayed at our house various times, people used to come and visit him and used to talk to him like we all can ask questions so freely of Utejaniya. And used to ask him all kinds of questions about life. And even, you know, he was an Anagarika, a ten preceptor. And he wore white robes. And he wasn't a married man or he didn't have children, but he was always so interested in the lay life. In fact, he didn't, his choice was not to be a monastic because he didn't want to feel separate from people who were in the lay life. He wanted to be able to sleep under the same roof and, you know, to communicate and commune with them in the ways that he chose to. So people would come and ask him all kinds of questions. And when it would get to the point where there'd be a little wrangling or a little, you know, back and forth or a little Dharma combat, Munindra would just stop. And he was able to do Dharma combat, you wouldn't believe. He would stay up hours and hours and hours. I mean, Joseph Goldstein tells a story about Munindra would not stop giving the Dharma until the last person left the room. He would just keep answering a question and keep on going. But there came a point where maybe he could see that that person had to depend on his or her own faith. And he would just say, the Buddha said, come and see for yourself. The Buddha showed the way, but you have to walk the way. And until you do that for yourself, you won't know. You won't really know. And I remember going to him one time and I said, people argue about the Dharma. They like to, you know, give the opposite view. And I can't find ways to sometimes to respond back. You know, I get a little nervous early on in my Dharma sharing. And he said, you know, the Buddha would always say, the world argues with me. I do not argue with the world. And just come and see for yourself. Walk the path yourself. Bring your own experience that develops into a wisdom that's unshakable. Basically, the Buddha said that there is a way, of course, a path to the end of suffering. He pointed that out as the Eightfold Noble Path. And that way was pointed very clearly. The Eightfold Noble Path basically has ways and means for a clarity of conscience to be able to live with our own minds and hearts that can feel more and more relatively clean and clear of blame, to develop a mind that's calm, to develop some concentration, so that from that place of calmness, some wise understanding can arise, wisdom can arise. Very early on in my life, in my Dharma life, I was in my 20s, and like many of you, my heart and mind turned towards the Dharma because of some deep and great inner need to understand life. I saw a lot of suffering in my life, as many of you have, and that's what turned my heart to the Dharma. At that time in my early 20s, I was married and lived in I came from a poor family, actually, and I was married into a very wealthy, political, high-ranking family in the Philippines. This was not wholly by my choice. It was more a family decision that I was there. And so I followed that family decision, and I didn't go in a way that was resistant. And so I found myself there. And I saw a lot of suffering, a suffering that just blew my heart open in a way. Because I was in a place of wealth and prestige and in a place where there were so many opportunities open to me, and I saw so many people where they didn't even have opportunity to live properly, to eat properly. And so the dichotomy of being in that place, of living in this extreme wealth and seeing extreme poverty, that suffering in life really stood out to me. And I never, from that point on, could turn my back to it. So I began to look for, it pushed me to looking deeper into life, to finding what is the meaning of this life anyway. It can't be just survival. It can't be, you know, helping those who are in survival. There has to be something more. So this is what turned my heart, in a way, to the Dharma. It said in various Buddhist commentaries that the cause for faith to arise is suffering. And so I could see when looking back, maybe not at that time, but in looking back, even not too long after that, I could see that that was the very place that a kind of faith, not dependent on outer conditions, not dependent on someone else's faith, but a deep faith, a deeper faith began to arise because of that suffering. And I think that's why, you know, some of our teachers, when we're suffering, they're happy that we're suffering. They see us opening to some ways of seeing our habitual patterns of our minds and our hearts. And, you know, they're happy that we're opening to dukkha, to that, the fact of suffering as it is. And so this faith, when it's turned on by suffering, basically, begins to clarify our spiritual objective. And that's one of the things that faith does. It's like a crystal, a certain kind of crystal that's put into water that's muddy, that starts to clarify that water. And we start to see clearly, what is the purpose of my life as a human being? Beyond the purpose of my life as being a daughter or a mother or a member of a community or a member of a social group or a member of a political group or a member even of the human race. What is even beyond that? What is my purpose in life? So it begins to point us like a compass to where, however far we want to look in those various degrees I just mentioned. Faith seeks out qualities, it said. It's faith is, it has a seeking quality. So there have been questions a lot about, what about a wanting? What about, you know, when we want to be enlightened, or another way of saying that is when we want to be purified of greed, hatred, and delusion, when we want to know the way to the end of suffering, when we want to attend a retreat, or we want to hear the Dharma, isn't that still greed? Isn't that still? But at some point in my own search about all of this, I came upon an understanding about how this wanting for unwholesome, that leads to unwholesome ways of being and unwholesome experiences of life, this is a seeking out, the same as faith is a seeking out. And a seeking out doesn't have to be unwholesome. It doesn't have to be in the realm of a defilement. We can seek out virtue. This is good. This is wholesome, to seek out virtue. We can seek out ways of being generous. We can seek out goodness to practice the paramis. We can seek out good friends, Dharma friends. We can seek out hearing the Dharma. In fact, I don't know how many of you are familiar with those three basic kind of personalities in Buddhist psychology. There's a greedy type, there's the aversive type, and there's a deluded type. Well, the opposite of the greedy type is the faith type. And it's because the greedy type and the faith type have a thing in common, and that is the quality of seeking out. But the greed type, in a deluded way, seeks out experiences that lead to suffering because of not knowing, because of delusion. And a faith-type person seeks out experiences that lead to liberation, that lead to freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion. So this seeking out is the compass. It's the compass that points us in a wise direction, in a direction that really maybe even goes beyond our aspiration. Maybe our aspiration isn't that far, to get to the end of suffering completely. Nibbana, you know, arahantship. But just by pointing ourselves in this direction, it will lead us there eventually. So for each of us, there is a unique way and a different opening of the heart and the mind. And for this reason, there are many teachings and many various ways that we can do it. And we're constantly opening to, because we're sophisticated human beings, we're being open to different ways of looking at practicing, as we are here, as you all are participating with Steve and I in opening our minds and opening our practices to ways that we can understand our minds that we haven't learned before. Methods, techniques, just plain old understandings. And so with this unique and different way that we, each of us, are, it attends to places in our hearts where we may have lost faith in one way of doing it. And so we try another way, or we add a bit of another way, and we find our faith comes up again, or our faith deepens, and we find that we can take another step. And so this has been important to me as I find ways to share the Dharma, to be able to find ways that will awaken the faith of everyone, and will attend to the various unique ways of people's hearts. One way doesn't always help. Even two ways don't always help. So we need more and more ways of looking at it and practicing. And every bit of it is important to awaken ourselves. Through our spiritual journeys, we all go through cycles, cycles that feel like it's smooth sailing, and maybe cycles where we feel like we've been on a kind of spiritual plateau. And it's important to be able to be with that and not kind of get stuck in a parking lot of spiritual parking lot and just kind of feel that, oh, this is fine. You know, this is fine for me, and not feel like we need to go any more than that. This happens when we get really comfortable with where we are, and maybe we're not so aware of a little bit of fear of going beyond that. But it's important to notice whatever is there, so that if there is too much comfort, to challenge ourselves, to open to things that we feel maybe resistant to, aversive to, and to actually do it and to see what happens to my heart when I do this. What happens to my heart when I go to something or I experience something that I previously thought I'd be resistant to? I was telling somebody today that I had an opinion that was a wrong opinion, I found out, about, I went to the Forest Refuge to practice, and they don't have any bells there. And the way that the practice goes there is quite, in a way, similar to how we're handling it here. It's quite open. There's only a few sittings to attend to, if you want to, every day. There's 2 Dharma talks a week, and there's no instructions in the morning. You go and listen to it on tape if you want to. And I guess they do ask you to do that. And you don't have very many interviews either during the week. And I thought, wow, I don't know. I do like to have more just spiritual friend contact, and I'm not sure about this. But I was willing to just drop and just explore. And, you know, I'm not that resistant to things. I'm pretty open-minded. And I found out that by going to things, that there were things that I was asked to go to that I wasn't sure I wanted to go to during that time. You know, things like the late chanting or something like that. But when I went, I was just with the resistance that was in my own heart and mind, just being open to that territory. And just to be honest about that, to be open about that with myself, awakened some wisdom in my own heart. Where we're sleeping, where we're stuck, where we're places inside where we're ignoring, that's really, it's really ignorant of us to do that. We're not seeing clearly. We're not honest enough with ourselves. And, you know, there's one place where I see a lot in myself where is a big stumbling block to having more faith with myself is where I'm not humble enough. I'm just not humble enough to get past my own highfalutin ideas. And to just go to that metta sitting that we don't want to go to and see what's going on in our own hearts, to go to that chanting or to, you know, to do the refuges and precepts and see what's happening there, and not to get stuck in our old ways of doing things, to really explore. This is what faith is all about, to explore beyond the realm of our comfort zone, to not get stuck in our comfort zones, because it can be a long time parking lot where we're not growing, or we're growing in small itsy bitsy ways that really are not worthy of our intelligence. So it's the faith to venture beyond those habitual patterns, those habitual tendencies of our minds and our hearts, which form really deep grooves. One of my friends and yogis said that this is the cow path of her mind. You know, where we were practicing once in a place where there are a lot of cows around, and you look out and there's these deep ruts in the ground, you know, and it's where the cows pass all the time to go to their troughs and to their feeding areas, and then they come back the same way. And she said, that's the thing I do. I just go in this cow path out there, and I come back, and I go there, and I come back. And it's like once in a while I look up and I see, wow, there's a whole big field out there. When am I ever going to step out there? You know, and so just kind of challenging herself to say, yeah, in one way, I can go to that other place. That's okay. It's new. There's not a path there, but I can make a path there. And maybe, you know, this deep cow path isn't the end-all and be-all of spiritual practice. Maybe there's other things that can happen. Open, be open to. So we get in touch with a deeper inner calling, a kind of spiritual urgency, the faith to venture beyond what is already known. And the various insights along the path of awakening are just that. It's venturing into a place that has not previously been experienced. It can be scary to go there. We need a lot of balance to be able to go there. We need a lot of the balance between faith and wisdom. And that is only created because when we have the faith to go to a place, then that deep wisdom is actually revealed to us. Because that wisdom is our own wisdom. It's not someone else's wisdom. It's our own wisdom that balances that faith and that creates a very stable mind to be able to be in unfamiliar, uncomfortable places. So faith is a quality of mind that when we look carefully, it's supported by the willingness to venture beyond what is previously known. Just that it's also that not just the willingness, but the curiosity to what is this? What is this feeling of discomfort all about? Instead of resisting it, can just go right into it. This feeling of aversion or this feeling of self-righteousness or this feeling of sadness. Whatever uncomfortable feeling, can there be the curiosity and the willingness to know that, to really experience it. So the willingness to be curious, to venture beyond what is known, which includes interest, you know, having the interest to do that. Are we really, sometimes I ask myself the question, am I really interested in the going forth? The going forth is not just going forth into the homeless life. That's the phrase that is used in, you know, when you take on the robes. But to me, it's the going forth into a place that will open wisdom. The interest to doing, am I interested enough to do that? Is there enough humility to do that? Because, you know, when we do that, it's, someone said once, the spiritual awakening, the spiritual path is one humiliation after another. You know, just being awakened time after time to places where we were asleep and we awakened to a defilement that we never knew was there, something that could have been very subtle, but very important, a very important key to the ongoing of our practice, to the going forth of our practice. The steadfastness of just keeping on, just keeping one foot in front of the other. It takes the energy of courage to do that. So these are qualities along the spiritual path. The Bodhisattva, the Buddha-to-be, was born into a royal family, and I look a lot about his life, a time in his life when maybe he had that deep inner calling to venture beyond the walls of the palace. So I'm using this particular story as a metaphor of faith, his faith, of his going forth, going beyond. And one day he decided to venture outside the walls of the comfort and luxury of his palace. And so it's said that when he gave one of his discourses to his monks, he said, "Monks, I lived in refinement, utmost refinement, total refinement. My father even had lotus ponds made in our palace, one where red, one where white, one where blue lotuses bloomed, all for my sake. I used no sandalwood that was not from Varanasi. My turban was of silk from Varanasi, as were my tunic. A sunshade was held over me day and night to protect me from cold, heat, and dirt. I had three palaces, one for the cold season, one for the hot, one for the rainy. During the 4 months of the rainy season, I was entertained by lady minstrels without a single man among them, and I did not once come down from the palace. But on that day, on one day, he ventured beyond the palace walls. And this is where it said, I don't know whether it's just a mythological story or true or not, but it makes a good point, where he faced in a powerful way the forces of ignorance and suffering. And it said that during this time, when he left the palace, he was awakened to sickness, old age, death, and a vision that could go beyond all of that, when the four heavenly messengers came to him. And the first heavenly messenger that he came upon when he left the palace with his attendant and his horse only, was he came upon a sick person, and he had never seen a sick person in his life, it is said. And when he came upon the sick person, he did not know what such a person was. The person was weak, was sweating, and did not have the vibrant glow in his body, could not stand up. And so he asked his attendant, "What is this?" And the attendant said, "This is one of the ways of the world, this sickness that comes upon people." And so the Buddha-to-be began to face this and the suffering of this, in the dukkha of this in this person, and indeed in the possibility of his own body and mind facing that. And then he came upon someone who was old, without any teeth, with wrinkled skin and bent over, and maybe the ravages of sickness that were wounds and marks on his body. And so asked, "What was this?" he asked his attendant. And for the first time became open to that fact of suffering, that fact of dukkha, and faced that suffering in a way that he never had to before. And then came upon someone who had died. And actually, it is said that in this particular story that his father and mother so protected him that he never came upon anyone who had died, because they kept this out of his sight because of various reasons, which I won't go into now. But he had never seen a dead person, and open to that fact of life, that part of life, which is the suffering that's part of life. And then the fourth heavenly messenger that the Buddha-to-be came upon was a mendicant monk, very, very peacefully walking through a place outside the palace walls in the village that was noisy and not calm and chaotic. And the Buddha-to-be sensed in this person the radiant calmness of his heart and his mind, his peaceful gaze and gait of his walk, and opened in his heart the possibility of being with all of this suffering in life, but still having some sense of peace, maybe some understanding that mendicant monk knew of, that he had not come across yet. And so it began to open the pathways of wisdom in his own heart, and that very, very deep inner calling to venture beyond was a very powerful kind of faith. It's something that each of us has, or else we wouldn't be here. That same kind of faith that this Buddha-to-be had in his own heart, we each have in our own hearts, and it's calling us to go further than we already are, to go to a place that will give us more stability in our hearts through wisdom, through understanding. So for each of us, coming here away from our homes, away from what's familiar, is an act of faith, to be with what is happening in our own hearts, to be with what is, without wavering, in a way that's as balanced as we can be, takes a lot of faith. It's said that there are three different kinds of faith, three basic different kinds of faith. Blind faith, bright faith, which can mature actually into mature bright faith, and verified faith. So a little bit about each one. And so we might find ourselves in the past, or a little bit of some of them even in the present moment. The blind faith is when we're not yet trusting our own experience. Maybe sometimes we even have a little bit of it now, when we get to places that are really those very deep cow paths of the mind, and it's more like an abyss than a cow path, and we don't know what to do there. And we can't immediately trust our own experience, our own wisdom, usually because we don't know it very well yet. Maybe not know it at all. Maybe we're not so accustomed to knowing it over and over again. Maybe we haven't explored that inner terrain deeply enough or enough times. Sometimes we have to go over this terrain again and again before we can feel comfortable with it and know our own hearts. Sometimes this blind faith is recognizing that we've misplaced our trust. We've put our trust in other things, in other people, in just book knowledge. There's some faith we can put in that, but unless we use it, it doesn't become ours. So actually in blind faith, we have something to begin with. Maybe it's just enough to follow instructions, but not understand why we're following those instructions. It's really a wonderful thing that we're able to have a teacher or teachers that can explain to us the why of something. When we ask ourselves, why is it like this, and we don't know why, we can ask someone and begin to understand for ourselves. But when we do things without understanding why, this is faith without wisdom. It's just really a blind faith. It has the kind of energy that follows instructions mechanically, with a dull energy in the present moment. As a result, we don't actually recognize what's going on within oneself moment to moment. One thing that I appreciate that Utejaniya points out is that mindfulness is not enough. You know, bringing attention to the present moment is not enough. And in the practice that we have been practicing all these years, it has, mindfulness in the present moment has led us to understanding wisdom in a very understanding, a deep kind of wisdom, over time and very, very organically. And that wisdom has arisen in many of us in various understandings about the impermanence of every moment, about the emptiness of self, about the truthfulness, the fact of suffering. But what I really appreciate is the pointing out that it isn't mindfulness that's really doing the work of freedom there. It is the wisdom that's doing the work, the wisdom that the mind opens to that's freeing us. You know, there used to be the saying that I don't think I've ever said is that let mindfulness do the work. But I would hear that saying. It's actually mindfulness that brings us to the present moment, but it's wisdom that does the work of freeing the mind. Mindfulness simply reflects what's happening in the present moment. And the wisdom that we get from knowing that clear reflection of the present moment is what is freeing the mind. It's understanding, our own deep understanding that's freeing the mind. So I knew for myself from times in the past that I was content to hear from others, and I was content to hear about others and to live their spiritual life vicariously when I think about my own spiritual life 30 years ago. And I was content to kind of be entertained by their spiritual experiences, but then it became not enough. I was content kind of to live in their love, live in their light. And then, you know, it wasn't respectful of my own intelligence. So that kind of faith doesn't last long, and it doesn't take your practice very deep. Manindra used to always say, he'd always give a lot of help, but when he knew it was, you know, asking too much, he would say in a bit of a scolding way, because I allowed him to do that, actually, because I allowed myself to be admonished. I really appreciate it, and I still do, having someone to admonish me. If we don't have someone like that, then what's in us that needs to be pointed out maybe won't be pointed out as quickly. So he would scold me and say, "You must walk the path by yourself. I cannot do it for you." And just really, it was his faith in me that turned me towards having faith in myself. It was like, "You can do it." It was a way of saying, "You can do it." Just recently, in a couple of years ago when I practiced with Upandita, I went to him in one of my last interview and I said, "Sayadaw Ji, beloved Sayadaw, I'm so grateful to be able to practice with you. Because when I practice with you," I said something like this, "my practice deepens." And he said, in a scolding, very, very tough way, that the interpreter also said, and she's a very soft-hearted nun, Masaru, and she said in the same tone, quickly, to me, "Do not say that." It was like, you know, put your faith in yourself, not out there. Don't depend on me. So I do appreciate that very, very much. So then there is the bright faith. And bright faith is when a person, a place, a reading, or the hearing of the Dharma, some begins to light a flame of possibility for us. And it brightens our faith. And it's not like depending on the light out there or on the flame of the Dharma out there. It begins to show us the flame in our own hearts. And our own inner light is clearly happening. It might be just a flicker, but we catch sight of it in a way that's exciting and starts to bring some confidence in ourselves. There might be still a degree of dependence on someone else, but that degree of confidence in ourselves is much greater. And so we know why we're following directions now. We're not following them mechanically, but we've understood why we're following these directions. And even though the faith has been ignited by others, we have seen that, oh, that person did it, and they followed these instructions. Many of you have read about Deepama, the householder mother who went through a lot of suffering in her life. And Manindra had told me about her early on in my connection with the Dharma. And so even though I never really met her, I felt really close because Manindra was also her teacher. And every time I would see Manindra, he would tell me about what Deepama was doing, you know, tell me little stories. They were actually very far out if you read the book about her. But my mind was okay about listening to those mystical stories. After all, you know, I heard stuff like that about people in the Philippines that could do, you know, psychic healers and all of that. But he always pointed out that even though she had these incredible abilities that came from her powers of concentration, for example, just to pique your interest a little bit, I said, he was telling me about Deepama one time when I was saying, Manindraji, I've got these four children and I have to get them to school. I have to bathe them. I have to make the money to pay the mortgage. And I have to, you know, I've got two of them that I'm sending to college. And it's really, really hard. And how can I study? And he would say, people can do, you know, Deepama has done this, you know. And I said, but how? Deepama is very, very special powers. And I thought, well, I'll never have those kind of powers. But anyway, but tell me about it. And he said that she really wanted to study, but she had to do all this cooking and, you know, she had her family and she really wanted to go to the school to study Pali and the Abhidhamma, one or the other or both. And so she decided she was going to do it, but to take the bus to go that far away, it took too much of her time. So she decided she wasn't going to do that. So she would disintegrate and reintegrate at the classroom. Now, this is what I'm telling you, what Manindra said, and he wouldn't lie to me. And so then she would show up there and take the lessons and then disintegrate and reintegrate back in the house, back in her home. And it would be quicker, you know. But then he said, you shouldn't do that. Don't use your powers of concentration because then it will take away from your opening to really deep wisdom and liberation. And so, you know, if we use concentration too much, we can't go on to liberation. You can get stuck there. So she said, well, she thought about using another way. So she didn't tell Manindra right away, but then she would use her audio clairvoyant powers, huh? And she would stay, huh? Clear ear. She would stay in her house and she would meditate and she would open to a lesson at the school and then she would be there and then she wouldn't leave her, but she would use those powers. I haven't gotten there. I don't really have any intention to make those kind of powers, but he would say, a householder can do it. You can do it too. It really encouraged me. And from the very beginning, he would say, you can reach Nibbana. It's not impossible. And I said, you know, I really have that understanding in my heart. It's really like, how come we don't talk about it so much? Maybe because in our culture we get too competitive. I don't know. But so this is a bright faith where it inspires our aspiration to go beyond the beyond. And we find that flame in our own hearts. And when it's mature, when this bright faith is mature, there's courage and there's confidence that we've never felt before. We have that unwavering commitment to do what we need to do. And we get to that place where we really touch base in that, with that spiritual urgency to do what we need to do. And so there are times in our practice where we can just, without striving, and this is really important, that we not strive like with a competitive, with ourselves or others kind of striving, or we don't do it in a way where we're greedy for spiritual experience, but we do it in a way where we're feeling in a balanced openness to letting the organic revealing of the Dharma happen, where we just can allow that. When there's enough energy, we can stay awake. When there's not enough energy, we let ourselves rest. When we can take that one last step in walking with clear, balanced attention, then we do that. And we know when it's not happening. Maybe for moments we turn our attention to what's happening in the mind and see what's going on there. Maybe we still can take a next step. But we follow a way that's really, really balanced. And so we come to a place of verified faith when our own trials and tribulations, through that, we know the way for ourselves and nothing can stop us from keeping on. The flame of conviction, of deep conviction, is not affected by the winds of change. Actually, the winds of life make us stronger, make faith stronger. We open to them. We're glad when they can be seen. It's sometimes when there's an opening to something difficult, it may be for a while like, oh, but it, after a short while, there's this happiness that, you know, I'm glad they're being seen rather than being hidden. So this unshakable faith comes. Of course, we still respect and value the light and wisdom from others and still learn from that. We're not so, pompous that we don't accept even from, the garbage collector or someone that we think might not be able to give us any words of wisdom. We respect everything and we learn from everything. Nothing that happens inside or outside can give rise to doubt anymore. It's maybe we still sometimes have some wavering about, can I really get through this difficult time? And we might have a temporary shaking up about, can I do this? But we don't have doubt about the path to the end of suffering. We know that if we can take that step, it will lead us there. So on a practical level, faith is that ability to take the step into this next moment. It's a faith to know, can I just know this next moment without wavering? We don't have to look that far ahead. Someone recently told me a story about one of these Tibetan chanters with the deep voices, one of the Gyoto monks, I think that's how you pronounce it. And he's a very shining person. And people want to interview him because he got out of Tibet through a lot of suffering and he had to hike long days and he was imprisoned and he went through a lot. But he's shining through all of that because of this depth of understanding that he learned by facing all of that outer and inner suffering. And people want to interview him and ask kind of the head monk or somebody who represents them, can we interview this person, this particular shining monk? And they say, he doesn't have much to say. If you ask him about these trials and tribulations, all he will say is, when they say, how did you do it? He will only say, I just took one step at a time. And that's how he did it. And that's how we do it in our lives. So the Buddha called faith like a seed. This seed is like this small intention to just be able to, I'll just take this one step, or this one moment of generosity, or this one moment of gratitude, or this one moment of wholesome metta, or this one moment of developing equanimity. And we don't know what's going to happen to that intention every time we incline the mind. The inclination of the mind to take the next step, to develop any of the Brahma-viharas or any of the paramis, is just a seed. It's like an intention. It goes into the darkness of the ground, the darkness of our hearts and minds, the karmic stream. It sends down roots, of course, into the darkness, and we never know when they will sprout, but they will surely sprout. Sometimes when I'm doing the metta practice or any of the Brahma-vihara practice, it's like, oh, another, may I be happy and peaceful. You know, another phrase or another. But you know what? I'd rather be saying that phrase, an intention, than what the mind might say if it's not saying that phrase. I'd rather, it's the choice. That intention is the choice to incline the mind towards balance, to incline the mind towards loving kindness, to incline the mind towards wisdom, towards compassion. I'd rather do that with full conscious mind than to just let it go hither and there. So that this kind of training is very important because of the seeds that it sends down. And faith is like that kind of a seed. But faith is also the incredible trust that we have to have in that seed to send down roots and then to send up shoots and to grow leaves and to bear the sweet fruit of liberation. The Buddha said that the characteristic of faith is trust. So to go to that place that's not known sometimes is just to trust in that seed that's in the darkness that we don't know. So when there's doubt, you know, when we're in a dark place, when there's confusion, when there's indecision, when there's a I can't do this mind, it just takes a moment to just pause and say, can I just incline the mind for a moment to the possibility that this seed of faith that I can open to whatever is happening here, can I just have confidence in that? Because oftentimes we just, you know, we want the quick fix. We want to just feel good right away rather than allowing the seed to grow roots and shoots and leaves and blossoms and fruit. There's Mary Oliver, as many of you know, talks about many Dharma qualities, I think, and she uses nature, which we can learn a lot from just being in nature. That's why I really love this kind of practice that we have, that we can just walk as much as we want, be out there and sit outside as much as we want to. We can learn a lot just from being and not doing the practice, being out there. And this is her poem about faith. It's she calls it the little summer poem touching the subject of faith. So here she's describing a cornfield, just in case you don't catch on right away. Every summer I listen and look under the sun's brass and even in the moonlight, but I can't hear anything. I can't see anything. Not the pale roots digging down, nor the green stalks muscling up, nor the leaves deepening their damp pleats, nor the tassels making, nor the shucks, nor the cobs. And still, every day, the leafy fields grow taller and thicker. Green gowns lifting up in the night, showered with silk. And so, every summer, I fail as a witness, seeing nothing. I am deaf to the tick of the leaves, the tapping of downwardness from the banyan feet, all of it happening beyond all seeable proof, all hearable hum. And therefore, let the immeasurable come, let the unknowable touch the buckle of my spine. Let the wind turn in the trees and the mystery hidden in the dirt swing through the air. How could I look at anything in the world and tremble and grip my hands over my heart? What should I fear? One morning in the leafy green ocean, the honeycomb of the corn's beautiful body is sure to be there. This is our faith. We don't hear anything, we don't see anything, but it's happening. It's all happening with every intention that we put forth. Inclining our minds towards goodness, inclining our minds towards wisdom, inclining our minds just this moment, one moment at a time. So let's sit for a moment.